This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Katie Ann McDonald is producing, and First Financial Tax and Accounting Services provides signature support. In studio is Jan Mohr, the president of the Louisiana Budget Project, and of course, an intrepid journalist back in his day, and he has covered the Capitol from both ends as a journalist and as an activist, and he is a man who knows the state budget quite well. In fact, are you still on the Board of Commerce and Industry?
I am.
You are.
Yes.
And so you're actually involved in things that the Board of Commerce and Industry weighs in on as well. And we're going to cover some ground. So if you'd like to chime in, 877-217-5757. But yesterday, in Ways and Means, some people who are of like mind to you tell me there was a victory of sorts. What happened?
Well, this was a bill dealing with the industrial tax exemption program, which, as listeners may know, is probably the most generous corporate tax incentive anywhere in the country. And until this governor came along, this was really a blank check program. You know, we have the State Board of Commerce and Industry that administers these industrial tax breaks that that really affect local government. You know, property taxes go to local governments. And what the governor has done via executive order is, for the first time in over 80 years, give local governments some control of those tax dollars. So when the Board of Commerce and Industry now passes a tax break, it then goes to the local governments to decide if they want to give these tax breaks. There was a bill in Ways and Means yesterday that would have taken away that authority of local governments to look at these tax breaks and decide whether they wanted to give it. So it essentially would have gone back to the rubber stamp days that we had in the state for 80 years. And there was an attempt by – now, I was not in committee. I was on the other side of the Capitol when the fireworks happened. But my understanding is that the author of the bill faced some opposition, some attempts to amend in the local government authority, which really, it's their money. They're the ones who should ultimately make that decision. And I guess the author got a little upset and pulled his bill from consideration.
And the author is?
Philip DeVillier of UNIS. And he is a, I guess, second-term Republican. And I think that, you know, down in the oil patch, down in, is where a lot of these, you know, this has been very unpopular with manufacturers because they don't want to go to the local authorities and explain why they need the money more than these local school boards and parish councils and sheriff's offices that rely on the tax dollars that these manufacturing corporations are supposed to pay.
All right. Well, in Louisiana, we have this generous payout, if you will, to business interests who want to do business in our state. And the question, of course, is whether that's necessary. We do have great abundant natural resources, as we know. We don't have any problem with workers who are needed for the jobs. So why do we do this? And how do we compare, with, for example, with the great state of Texas when it comes to giving these enormous tax incentives?
Well, when it comes to industrial tax incentives, we are far more generous than any of our neighbors. And this industrial tax exemption program, again, it's been on the books in our Constitution since the 1930s. You know, not long after Huey Long died, this got on the books, and it's kind of stayed that way for an extremely long time.
Right.
And the real question that nobody's ever answered is, would these corporations be here? Would they be doing this work in Louisiana but for this tax exemption? I think all the evidence that I've seen says they'd still come here. They're not here because of the tax incentives. They're here because the oil is here. The Mississippi River is here. The ports and infrastructure are here. The access to cheap energy, you know, stock fuel is here. There are a lot of reasons to locate, and we have a really great industrial construction workforce, probably the best in the world by some estimates. So there are a lot of reasons to put your petrochemical plant in Louisiana. The tax break that we give them, this enormous tax break that affects the ability of local governments to fund schools and so forth, that's lagniappe. And so I think hats off to Governor Edwards for making some much-needed reforms. Hopefully the legislature will not roll it back. I'll add one thing. You know, the voters last fall had a chance to weigh in on this. There was a constitutional amendment on the ballot that would have let corporations kind of bypass the ITAP process and negotiate their own deals with local governments.
Right.
that really was a sweetheart deal for corporations to be able to get even more generous breaks than we give them now, the voters rejected that decisively. So the voters see through what we're doing here and don't like it. And but the legislature kind of keeps coming back to, you know, to the well on this, and hopefully they'll see it differently.
Again, your number is 877-217-5757. You can email us at talk@talklouisiana.org. Jan Moeller, president of the Louisiana Budget Project, one of the exceptional watchdog groups in Louisiana government. And we are with him to get his review of a session in which tax reform is the mantra. Independent of this, what else is on the front burner?
Well, you're right. Tax reform is the big question, and there are, you know, hundreds of bills that have been proposed, you know, mostly on the House side, but a lot on the Senate. We were told heading into the session that the leadership of the House and Senate had agreed on a package, that they were going to move a package of bills that were revenue neutral, that were going to make some of these reforms that people have talked about for years. We're only 1 week into the session. So far, we haven't seen much evidence of this coordinated approach and this consensus that we heard so much about heading into the session. So right now on the House side, almost everything has stalled except for a package of bills by Representative Neil Reiser that would provide about $120 million in tax cuts for large corporations. That's the only thing that really has gone through. There was another couple of bills on the Senate side that's gone through. The big question, I think, for policymakers is this going to be revenue neutral? You know, the governor has said he's not going to sign off on anything that actually costs the state money in the long run through tax cuts. You know, that's the mistake Louisiana has made in previous years when we had lots of money in the budget, and this is a year when we have some money. Mm-hmm. In the past, you know, the history of Louisiana is to squander that on tax cuts. And then 2-3 years later, there's a giant hole in the budget, and we're cutting higher education, and we're cutting Medicaid, and everybody wonders what happens. Well, it's the tax cuts that happened. Governor Edward wants to avoid that. The question is the legislature going to try to challenge that and carve their own path?
877-217-5757 is your number. And Doug in Goodwood, you are on Talk Louisiana. Hi, Doug.
Good morning, gentlemen. A couple of points, I guess. One is that, you know, we and everyone else play into an agenda when we use that term tax reform. They've got us doing that. They call it reform. As Mr. Mueller's pointed out, it's really a giveaway to some powerful interests. And tax cuts of any kind are not free. If they're not paid for, they either add to a deficit or they lead to some kind of cut having to be made somewhere. And as he's pointed out, we'll hear in a couple of years if they get these through, well, we have a spending problem. We don't have a revenue problem. It's like, well, you eliminated the revenues, so that's the problem.
Doug, I think you're exactly right. And I think in a state, you know, states have to balance their budgets. Mm-hmm. We don't have the luxury that the federal government does of printing more money and borrowing money in bad times. We have to raise what we want to spend. And so even when you're talking about revenue neutral tax reform, if that's what they end up doing, somebody's going to pay more and somebody's going to pay less. And the people who pay more are the ones who are going to be screaming. And usually the people who end up paying less are the ones who have the power and the influence at the state capitol. So what we try to do at the Budget Project is to make sure that anything they do on taxes protects the people who don't make a lot of money, who are struggling to make ends meet, and who really need state services. I mean, the people who need public schools, the people who need a healthcare infrastructure, those are the folks who really need to be protected from what the legislature may do on taxes.
Lou on Highland Road. Lou, good morning.
Good morning. I have a question. In the recent news reports, they said that this.
I'm sorry, Lou, you're fading.
Maximum rate at 2.5%.
All right, Lou, you're fading in and out.
Just a second. Let me see if I can get closer to the. So in the news. Hello?
Yeah.
You're heard. Go ahead.
Yeah, the news report said that they were going to try to push through 5% income tax rate and get rid of the federal deduction, and that Louisiana was the only state with a federal deduction. But in fact, I had read there's about 6 or 7 states with the federal deduction.
All right. Thank you, Lou.
Well, Lou is right. There are 6 or a handful of states that have the federal income tax deduction. Most of those states cap that deduction. There are only 2 states right now that have the ability to deduct all of your federal taxes on your state return. And that applies to corporations and individuals. And that those two tax breaks are worth about $840 million.
And those two states are?
Louisiana and Alabama, and Louisiana is the only one that has it in their state constitution. And so I think that's the key to any tax reform. Lou is right.
877-217-5757, back after this 90-second pause. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757 is your number. One more segment with Jan Moeller, president of the Louisiana Budget Project. We'll be calling on him again. And come Monday, we are slated to hear from Maggie Conneroe, who's with Together Louisiana. Sometimes they work in concert. And I think one of the things that most activists on the, quote, progressive side are in concurrence about is an increase in the minimum wage. Louisiana's right there at $7.25. Well, the great state of Arkansas, I think, is up to $11 now and going up beyond that. Very soon to 12. So what's going on, Jan Moeller, and why can't the governor of Louisiana twist enough arms to make this happen?
That's a really good question, Jim. I've been, this is my ninth, I've had this job now for almost 10 years, and I've been going up to the Capitol and talking about a minimum wage just about all of those years, and, you know, it's Groundhog Day. This is one of those areas where you know, a lot of times I think legislators really do reflect the will of their constituents, but the minimum wage is an exception to that, Jim. This is every single poll I've ever seen on this shows broad support for raising the minimum wage. Republicans, Democrats, urban, rural, white, black, everybody understands that $7.25 is not a fair wage, not a livable wage, not something that anybody can get by on, and that it needs to go up. But the House Labor Committee, which is where these bills go to die, just hasn't moved. Now, last year we had pandemic. We didn't really have this debate. So this will be the first time that this new legislature, you know, we had obviously term limits. A whole bunch of new people got elected in the fall of 2019, and they came in last year. Had a very, you know, had about 1 week of normal legislative life, and then the pandemic struck. So we don't really know how they're going to react to this. Hopefully, they will see what their constituents see, which is the wage, the minimum wage right now is not enough. And if we want to address poverty in Louisiana, which is really probably our biggest problem from our perspective, then people who work need to be paid more for that work. It's not any more complicated than that.
Okay, so the governor, in his opening salvo to start the session, he's tried hard, but he doesn't have the clout in the Capitol because he doesn't have a numerical majority, and he has a distinct minority. In fact, even a veto-proof majority in the Senate, if all 27 senators and who are Republicans vote against him, then anything he does or gets done could be overturned as far as a veto. But on this, is there a number? Is there a magic number? Is it $9, $11, $15? What is it?
Well, so the governor, I mean, I think 15, certainly something we support, but I think that's probably a little bridge too far in Louisiana. But I think one thing that's changed from the last few years is there's nobody on our side of this debate who's excited about $8.50 or $9 an hour, which were the proposals a couple of years ago. I think 10 or 11 is probably where this would end up if it gets some legs. I just don't get the sense that there's a lot of momentum or excitement among activists for anything less than $11 an hour. I mean, if we can't do as well as Arkansas on the minimum wage, where the minimum wage has really helped in Arkansas. And all of these predictions you hear about job losses and just don't come true. I mean, we have real-world examples of what happens when the wage goes up. When the wage goes up, people have more money to spend. They spend that money in their community, and it helps the overall economy.
Gustavo in Goodwood. Hi, Gustavo.
Good morning, and hope you have you're having a great day in spite of the weather that we've been experiencing. I'm an expert on minimum wage analysis, literally, because I was in a minimum wage industry for many, many years, all of my professional life. And there are so many things that I would like to say, but let me say that a minimum wage is a starting wage for somebody to grow from there. The problem is that we are considering a minimum wage as a living salary, as a living way of life. You cannot do that. I'm sorry. I started making $14,000 a year in 1983. And it was, if I would have been stuck with that salary, I wouldn't have had the kind of life that I have and that I was able to give to my children.
It is a starting wage for a lot of people. And, yes, there are teenagers and there are people just starting out in the workforce who make that. I would just note that if the minimum wage had just kept up with inflation from 1968, yeah, it would be well over $11 an hour right now. If it had kept up with inflation and productivity, it would be over $20 an hour today. So we're not asking for something unprecedented. We're just asking for the minimum wage to keep up with the growth of the economy, with the growth of GDP, and maybe keep a little pace with the growth of productivity. You know, workers are a lot more productive. They get a lot more done now than they did 30, 40, 50 years ago. They're just not seeing the gains from that labor the way that we did in America for a long time. You know, productivity and wages kind of kept up with each other for a long time, you know, from the end of the Second World War until the mid-70s, and then it started to diverge. And that's when we saw this kind of division, this rise of income inequality in Louisiana, mm-hmm, and in America, and that's what we're trying to address. You know, raising the minimum wage isn't going to fix 45 mm-hmm years of income, rising income inequality. It's just going to level the playing field a little bit.
In 1975, when I had my first job working on a loading dock, I earned $2.20 an hour. I presume that was a minimum wage, 1975. Yeah. And I'm looking today, that would be worth $11. Some would say even that's low, but it's much higher than $7.25.
And I made $3.35 an hour in 1985 bagging groceries. So, I mean, we've all been there, but I think, again, and there are people who don't get past minimum wage. There are people who spend their career in retail work or in restaurants.
Minimum wage.
Restaurant workers, yeah, that's a whole other subject, but they make less than minimum wage. So yes, for some it's a starter wage. For some it's their career, and they need help.
Dan downtown. Dan, you're on. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. Now, Mr. Mueller, would you say that the corporate lobbyists really earn their great fees, considering how the Republican legislators pander to them, despite what their own constituents, to say nothing of less well-off Democrats and independents?
All right, Dan's fired up. What do you think?
Absolutely. I think lobbyists, you know, and I don't blame the lobbyists. I mean, if I was a massive corporation in Louisiana, I would want to hire the best people possible to represent me at the legislature, and they certainly earn their money. I think that the folks we need to watch are the legislators, because they represent constituents and they need to understand when they take a vote, are they helping their contributors or are they helping the people they represent? I mean, they're the ones who are accountable to us, not the lobbyists.
Patrick in Inniswald. Patrick, you're on.
Yeah, hey. Well, also, the lobbyists also represent a lot of special interests, unions, leftist groups. But let's talk about minimum wage. So you think a high school kid who lives at home with his parents should be able to get a job for, you know, should be paid $15 an hour?
Yes, I do.
Yeah. Well, if they're working and producing, and many of these businesses who are members of lobby and the chamber, they don't pay anybody below $15 an hour, yet they,
absolutely,
the governor has said they just don't want to be told what to do.
I think that's a lot of it. I think most of the members of lobby, I don't think, could hire somebody for their business at $7.25 or even $9 an hour. So I think for some of them, it's just kind of a, you know, muscle memory, and they don't like regulation, and they kind of reflexively oppose anything that looks or smells or feels like government regulation. But we've had the minimum wage in on the books in this country since the 1930s.
What do you think would happen if it were put to a vote?
It would pass overwhelmingly. Everywhere that people have had the chance to vote on the minimum wage, it has passed. If we had a ballot measure system in Louisiana where you could get signatures and put something on the ballot, we would go that route, and mm-hmm. we would have this on the ballot, and I can almost guarantee you it would pass.
Well, Jan Mueller, thank you for your good work, and we'll be calling soon, and the session will be evolving. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana, and we're joined now by Brian Moody, the Executive Director for Auto Trader, and, of course, the world is evolving with purchases of automobiles as more and more people are going the electric route, and soon that may become the wave, as General Motors has announced that by 2035, that's what GM will be doing. And good morning to you, Brian Moody.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Well, where are we right now? Or is this a brave new world, or is somebody going to put the brakes on it and keep things the way we're accustomed to as far as the way we purchase our vehicles, and we like these gas guzzlers, and that's what we mostly see on the roads these days?
I think it's a little bit of both. I think that what we're seeing right now is that there's electric cars are getting sort of a disproportionate amount of the attention, but they don't make up a huge part of the market. They make up about 2% of the market. I think that's going to go up. That's probably going to increase to 4%, say, by 2022. But the big thing is going to be, like you said, I think the reason that people continue to buy the kind of cars they've always bought is because they assume that they're going to like that better. My opinion is that if the average family were to get a, you know, mid-sized SUV that was completely electric powered and was priced at around $35,000, I think they would like that better. I think they'd be very pleased with that vehicle. But they have to give it a chance. They have to try. And, you know, once they do, or once their neighbors do and say, oh, we love it, then that's going to start to change the conversation.
Well, right now, what does the average electric vehicle cost?
Well, they're a little bit more expensive than a gasoline-powered car. So right now you see electric cars at the low end of the range being, say, $36,000 for a Chevy Bolt, maybe $30,000-ish for the base version of a Nissan Leaf, all the way up to $70,000 or $80,000 or more for the increasing number of luxury electric cars that we see, like Tesla, Jaguar, Audi, and Porsche.
Mm-hmm. Now, for many, Brian, as you know better than most of us, a car is a statement. And not only do we want it to function well, we want it to look good. Do these electric vehicles look good?
Sure. Yeah, I think there's a couple. I'll tell you a couple of specific ones that I really like. And if given the choice, I would pick it of my own free will, not because it's electric. The Lincoln Aviator there's a version of it called the Grand Touring, which is a plug-in hybrid, which means you plug it in and drive around on electricity for a short time, then a gasoline engine kicks in later. I also think the Volkswagen ID4, completely electric car, very good looking, inside and out, very impressive. Same with the Volvo XC40 Recharge. Those are all good looking cars. They do make a statement. They're nice inside. They're nice to look at on the outside. And they actually perform nicely.
877-217-5757 for Brian Moody, the executive editor for Auto Trader. Barry in Mid-City. Hi, Barry.
Good morning. I test drove an electric car, a Bolt, a few days ago, but it is only good for like 250 miles, and they said a couple years, maybe 400 miles. That concerns me. Also, I understand that there are places where you can just go in and a robot will change the batteries in the car.
All right. Where are we going as far as the technology, Barry? And Brian, it's you're the expert.
Well, there was a company called Better Place, and I believe it was an Israeli company, and they did experiment with this idea where you go drive into a service station type of thing, and there's a mechanism that robotically removes the battery pack, and then it puts a new one in, and then you get to drive for 200 more miles or whatever it is. So similar to visiting a gas station, I guess, except it would be automated. That didn't work out too well. I don't know that that's going to be the future, because that means you have to build the car in a very certain way. So, yes, the point of all this is to say that range is a concern for people. And I agree that range is a concern for people. And often people say, well, we need the infrastructure. We need to install chargers. Okay, that's true. That's a good idea. But what people aren't considering is that even when you do have those chargers, it's going to take hours to charge your car up, not minutes like going to a gas station. And I don't know if people are ready for that. I think hydrogen is a good option. Hydrogen fuel cell cars are electric cars that use compressed hydrogen to make that electricity.
All right, Ann on Jefferson Highway. Ann, you're on with Brian Moody, Executive Editor, Auto Trader. Hi, Ann.
Hello. My main problem with the electric cars is that I live in an apartment complex, and there just are very few places that you can charge the car.
All right. What about that?
That's a great point. That's a really good point. And at this point, there really isn't a solution for that. And I think what you're seeing is that a lot of these solutions for electric cars are definitely aimed toward people who are, I mean, I don't know how else to say it, but they're people who can afford nice things. And it's not designed for people who are, well, I don't own my own home, or I don't like that kind of thing. Now, that may be a lifestyle choice, but it's definitely an issue, and I don't know how that one gets solved because the apartment is owned by a private person.
All right, David in Atlanta, please be brief. You're on with Brian. Hi, David.
Okay, it's my understanding that Red Toyota has an electric vehicle that they have developed or will develop that can charge in 10 minutes from did nothing to fully charged. And the beauty of an electric motor is 80% of the energy in a gasoline or diesel engine is wasted in heat. Only 20% is wasted in heat with an electric vehicle, so we could burn less fossil fuel to generate the electricity.
All right. Is that a valid point of view from David in Atlanta, Brian?
Yeah, I think he might be speaking of the Toyota Mirai, which is a hydrogen fuel cell car, and it does refuel in about 10 minutes.
All right. For people who want more information, best place to go?
You can go to autotrader.com, and we have our list of the 10 best electric cars for 2021, and we included some plug-in hybrids as well, and maybe there's a one that you're willing to try out.
Well, we thank you for your insights and look forward to a conversation. This is The Wave of the Future. Brian Moody, Executive Editor for Auto Trader. Good to visit with you.
Thank you.
Thank you. We're joined now by Fairleigh Jackson for a few moments. She heads Preserve Louisiana. And this organization, like all cultural associations, organizations in our community and beyond, has been affected by COVID, but the beat goes on, and there is an event this weekend. And tell us more, Fairleigh Jackson.
Hello, Jim. Thank you for having me. It's good to hear your voice and good to be able to share this with your listeners. As you mentioned, we are having a very low-key event. This is going to be a Facebook Live on Preserve Louisiana's Facebook page and also broadcast from the Slave Dwelling Projects page. We'll have our colleague and friend, Joseph McGill, who's the director of the Slave Dwelling Project, on with me, and we'll be having a dialogue at the Oakley Historic Site, where we and a few other guests participated in a slave dwelling experience by spending the night there a few years ago. So we'll be talking about that experience 3 years ago, the efforts to expand the narrative at historic sites around the country, where Joe travels around and meets with the leaders of cultural entities to expand the narrative and tell the importance of these former dwellings of the enslaved. And we'll also probably dive into our always controversial and interesting discussions around Confederate monuments and much more. So we hope your listeners can tune in to our Facebook Live on Sunday at 5:30 on the Preserve Louisiana Facebook page.
All right, 5:30 this Sunday, Central Time. Preserve Louisiana Facebook page. Now, When you talk about a slave dwelling experience, there obviously is not a way to really recap that full experience.
No, you're correct. There's not.
Go ahead. Now, you said you did this 3 years ago. How did that work?
It was wonderful. We had a panel discussion the night before at the old governor's mansion where John House, who is the director of the Audubon Historic Site, and a couple other of our cultural colleagues talked about the importance of expanding the narrative, and it was facilitated by Maxine Crump with Dialogue on Race. So we did that the night before, and then we all met at Oakley Historic Site and sat around a campfire with Mr. John House and Joe McGill, and John House was able to tell us a lot about, the little details they have of the life of the enslaved. As you know, Jim, there's not a lot of documentation, and there was not a lot of effort put into knowing the life of the enslaved. So we talked a little bit about that. Joe talks about his experiences around the country and efforts to preserve these spaces, whether or not they're actual structural entities or just the sites where these former dwellings existed. So that's really the best approach that we can do to that. For that. But as you mentioned, it is definitely a mission of ours and many others to make sure that these important sites that help build these larger homes and historic sites, that the life of the enslaved is shared with our world.
Well, these plantation homes, many of which have rich artistic value, are under fire for some who say, look, they should just be burned to the ground and that we should eradicate that from the past. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I think that this approach is probably better for everyone, where, you know, we actually do put an emphasis on telling the full story. I am actually in favor of starting the dialogue and starting tours of these sites at the places of the enslaved who built these sites. You know, when we talk about the past, we usually start from the beginning, right? So if we're talking about the splendor and the grandness of the architecture of these spaces, we should definitely start with talking about who physically built them as well.
Well, Fairley, we wish you well. 5:30 Facebook Live this Sunday, and it will be a discussion about a topical issue, and we commend you for your work at Preserve Louisiana. We have much history that we want to keep alive and have others exposed to. Thank you, Fairley.
Thank you so much, Jim.
And we'll return with more after this pause on Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. And we turn the page and we're joined by Rick Pender, who's been a music critic and aficionado in the business since the mid-1980s. And his work is the Stephen Sondheim Encyclopedia. And for those who know Mr. Sondheim, he has hailed as one of the great composers of all time, going back to West Side Story. And he is a guy who still has relevance today, born March 22, 1930, 91 years ago. And Rick Pender, when you talk about his body of work, it's an expansive body, and I'm sure the encyclopedia is reflective of that.
Well, it certainly is, and thanks for the opportunity to come and talk about it. This book took me close to 2 years to put together. It is about 650 pages, has 131 entries, covers all 18 of Mr. Sondheim's shows, entries about his life in particular, but other aspects of his career, including awards that he has won, and then profiles of the many, many, many people that he has worked with, Broadway stars, directors, designers, and so on.
877-217-5757 in our time with Rick Pender, the author of the Stephen Sondheim Encyclopedia. And Sondheim has probably been awarded as many diverse honors as anybody living today. He's in the Songwriters Hall of Fame. He won the Pulitzer Prize for Drama, the Edgar Allan Poe Award. He's in the Theater Hall of Fame, Kennedy Center Honor, National Medal of Arts, Library of Congress Living Legend. How does he handle all his success that has come through the years?
You know, I think he is grateful for the awards and the recognition, but that's not what he creates shows for. He really is about the work of art and about creating music. You know, he's unusual in that he is both a composer and a lyricist. Many of the people who create musical theater work in teams. You know, we've heard of Rodgers and Hammerstein, for instance, Richard Rodgers being a composer and Oscar Hammerstein being a lyricist, and sometimes the guy who wrote the script, the book for the show. But Sondheim does both halves of that, the musical side of this, lyrics and composition. So that is one of the things that really sets him apart.
It's hard to believe, but he graduated from Williams College in 1950. He has been around a while. Was there the proverbial big break along the way?
Yes, there was. In fact, I just mentioned Oscar Hammerstein, a well-known lyricist, both partnered with the show Showboat, and then later with Richard Rodgers for his many shows. And as it happened, when Sondheim was a teenager, he grew up, his parents divorced, and he grew up on a farm in eastern Pennsylvania, not far from where Oscar Hammerstein lived. And Oscar Hammerstein sort of took him under his wing, gave him some advice about things. And then in the mid-1950s, when Sondheim was in his mid-20s, he had an opportunity to work with three titans of the Broadway stage. That would be Leonard Bernstein, Arthur Lawrence, and Jerome Robbins. Bernstein being a composer and a renowned conductor, Lawrence being a playwright, and Robbins being a choreographer and director. They were working on a show that came to be known as West Side Story. And Bernstein had originally thought he would do both music and lyrics, but with Jerome Robbins involved, he needed to compose a lot of dance music, so he needed someone else to do the lyric writing. Sondheim was proposed to him by his friend Arthur Lawrence, who wrote the play, the script that they followed for that show. He was a little reticent about doing it because he wanted to compose and write lyrics. But this was an opportunity to work with some great people. Oscar Hammerstein said, if you're looking for a big break, this is the one for you. You'll be working with people who are already well-known on Broadway. It will give you excellent connections toward the future.
877-217-5757 and talk at talklouisiana.org for Rick Pender, the author of the Encyclopedia of Stephen Sondheim, who keeps on doing it. And you mentioned West Side Story in the early 60s. A listener asks about A Little Night Music, which was 1973. That one is an amazing piece of work as well.
It is. It is to see it today and hear it today, you'd say, well, this seems like an operetta. Lots of lovely singing in it, and in fact, all the music in it are waltzes. And it is a show about basically several couples, sets of people who are in love. They are married to some people and in love with other people. They get entangled and then unentangled as the story unfolds. But it is a lovely piece of music and witty lyrics. It's a wonderful, mm-hmm. wonderful, entertaining show.
And that show included Sondheim's biggest hit, if you will, and Send in the Clowns. And Holly in the Garden District asked if the clowns refer to circus clowns.
Well, sort of. There is a thing in show business that when something goes wrong in a circus or in any kind of show, what do you do to distract people? Well, you send in the clowns. So that is sort of what this is about. But really, it is a woman who is sort of feeling kind of bitter. She's been in love with a man. He's now married to a much younger woman. They've had some spark of maybe their relationship starting up again, but she thinks maybe it's not going to happen. Mm-hmm. And she's feeling sad about it. And she's thinking, well, maybe we are the clowns. The last line of that song is, don't bother, they're here. She and this the gentleman, Frederick, who she's pining for, they are the ones that she thinks now are the clowns.
Well, Judy Collins charted with that song in 2 years, I believe, 75 and 77. But didn't Sinatra record it first?
He did. He also did. It was Collins' recording that got the Emmy recognition. But, yes, that was it. And Sondheim always says that that song is his. It's not. He doesn't have greatest hits. He said, that is my hit. Singular. But many people know his show. I mean, he's written many tuneful songs that over the years people have certainly become familiar with.
Yeah, I would not call Stephen Sondheim a one-hit wonder.
Absolutely not.
Well, he's had this remarkable body of work, but if you could pick one or two other standouts, what are your personal favorites, Rick?
Well, I always say to people, it depends on the day of the week and the one I've seen most recently. But the one that there are several that I would point to. One is Sweeney Todd, the Demon Barber of Fleet Street. Many people know it because a movie version of it was made by Tim Burton, starring Johnny Depp as this barber who is a serial killer. Again, a strange subject, but powerful music, a very tragic story about a man exiled to Australia by a corrupt judge, comes back to seek vengeance, has a hard time seeking vengeance on the individual that he wants to, and ends up directing his anger at pretty much anybody who comes to his barbershop. So that is, it's a powerful story with glorious music. It's almost more like an opera music throughout, underneath scenes like the underscoring in a movie. So that's one. In a much lighter vein, I would point to Into the Woods, which is based on fairy tales, a made-up tale about a baker and his wife, but other characters are Cinderella and Little Red Riding Hood and so on and so on. So that show is a lovely one. It's more or less appropriate for families, especially the first act of it. In the second act, things change a little bit and sort of reality sets in. It's sort of what happens after Happily Ever After. And it's not quite so happy, but it is realistic, and people learn to adjust to the new reality in their world. It has a lot of wonderful songs in it.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. The book is The Encyclopedia of Stephen Sondheim from Rick Pender. Rick, good work, and keep going.
Thank you so much for your interest. I hope that some of your listeners are eager to run out and buy a copy.
And it is out as of today, so it is an expansive book, more than 600 pages, everything and more about Stephen Sondheim. And we will, Katie Ann's pulled up, Send In the Clowns with Frank Sinatra to close. But before we get there, Nikki Fargus out as LSU basketball coach, resigning presumably under pressure after 10 years. There have only been 5 African-American head coaches at LSU in the history of the Old War School. Nikki's gone. Pokey Chapman was fired. Johnny Jones was fired. Tony Menace was fired. And Trent Johnson was about to be fired when he went off to TCU. So it's probably time. I think probably is a word that shouldn't be used. It is time for LSU to hire more African-American coaches. And we do thank you for listening this week. Back next week at the usual time. First Financial Tax and Accounting Services provide signature support as we go to the finish line for this week. Let's hear from the chairman of the board.
Quite a long time together, until one day one of them gets restless and decides to leave. Whether it's the man or woman who left is unimportant. It's a breakup. And it's a lovely marriage of words and music, written by Stephen Sondheim. Isn't it rich? Are we a pair? Me here at last on the ground, and you in midair.